Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.
It can get lonely climbing Mount McKinley, so to entertain myself, I go to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, I can play hundreds of online casino-style games for free, like online slots, bingo, slingo, and more. Plus, I get a daily login bonus. It's just too bad that up here, I don't have anyone to share my excitement with. Woohoo! Woo-hoo!
Live the Chumba life anytime, anywhere. Play for free now at ChumbaCasino.com. VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening. Hello and welcome to episode 6 or appendix A of our ongoing mini-series, Informal Economics for Traders. Eric Mason, the informal economist himself, is back from his recent accounting exile, and I brought in the rickest of the ricks, White Boy Rick, to help with the follow-up, Economic questions. Yeah, White Boy Rick to help with the follow-up, economic questions. Apologies, Dan Harmon. I feel like it kills the joke when you stumble over it for that much.
No, it made it better, Kyle. Don't lie.
All right. Last time we met, we talked about misleading headlines, and Eric was able to kind of tie that all together with everyday life and trading. Make sure I link the series notes for anybody that missed out. Tonight, the plan is simple. I'm going to introduce Rick to Eric, and I'm just going to sit back and eat some popcorn. Before we get to that, quick reminder, if you have any questions, comments, or overdue homework assignments, feel free to send them our way either by Discord, which you can join via the links in the show notes, or email us at bandittraderspodcast@gmail.com. Eric, you have anything you want to promote?
Registration open today. If anybody's local in the Boston area, I'll be doing my 2025 economic outlook for Gray, Gray, and Gray Associates. Just Google like Gray, Gray, and Gray year-end seminar, and the registration will be there. You can come there. I'm doing like an hour-long outlook for the U.S. economy and global economy for 2025, mostly heavily focused on like tax policy and the upcoming election. But there's a 15-minute Q&A at the end that you get to have a microphone and yell at me. So I don't know why anybody wouldn't want to do that. Gotta book the trip.
Somebody's got to get some bricks questions in there. Are they streaming that?
They won't be streaming it. They're probably 50-50 if they're going to be doing a live stream at the time. And then they'll also, but it'll be all like posted afterwards.
Is that gray, like the color gray, or gray like Dorian Gray?
I don't know what that second one was. Is that a Game of Thrones reference?
50 Shades
no,
of Grey.
No, Dorian Gray is the... That's a good one. But that, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. But not really.
Oh, no. I was thinking of 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, Jesus, I don't know. That's a good question.
I had to read that for Consequences about a year ago.
Did you actually read it?
Yes, I did.
It's a running joke in our family constantly. Like, I make fun of like my wife, or I'll make fun of like my sister-in-law and be like, talk about 50 Shades of Grey, and it's just like ridiculous. Like, you wonder why women are so like funny to deal with sometimes when they're reading stuff like that, where it's like she's getting beat up worse or he's getting beat up worse than going down Skid Row.
Man, I'm on the wrong. I got the complete wrong person anyway. Apparently, Dorian Gray is a movie from 2009.
For the record, it's G-R-A-Y. I don't know how we got on.
G-R-A-Y. Okay, thank you. All right, so I'll link that if anybody wants to check it out.
Yeah.
All right, what should we talk about tonight then? So, I don't know if you haven't met Rick yet, right?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe
so. Rick's been around the trading community with us for probably, I don't know what, last 3 years?
Yeah, about last 3 years. Yeah. I've traded full-time since 2021. Now I can't remember. April 2021, I quit my job in the Great Resignation. They said that April was when the Great Resignation during COVID happened. And I didn't realize it while I was doing it.
I didn't realize it either. I think I was part of that too.
I found out afterwards that I was, you know, not a trailblazer. I was following everybody else up right out the door. So that was great.
Oh, well, can't always be the first, right? Can't all no, be like can't. Eric.
Nope. Can't be nice and savvy.
Well, you kind of started things off at the beginning here with tariffs, and you promised me you'd keep this apolitical. So I'm going to go ahead and let you set the stage. You're trying to do before I hit the record button.
Well, so the good conversation around tariffs is, and what everybody really should be talking about, is their effect on the economy and are they really good or bad? There has been tons and tons and tons of econ papers that have been written about tariffs. And if you go back to when Paul Krugman won the Nobel Prize in economics, he's a Nobel laureate. He was a professor at Yale and a New York Times columnist. His was basically about balance of trade and tariffs. And it's you know, when it comes to the United States in general, we always have a deficit because we're always importing more than we're exporting, right? So why would it be then that the United States can still have positive GDP if they're a negative exporter? And then what do we think about tariffs? Because there's a lot of stuff in the news talked about with tariffs and what they are and if they're good or bad. And I kind of have an opinion because it seems that as things change, especially in economics, like as the world changes, technology advances, I think we need to go back and kind of reopen things like tariffs. Are they good or are they bad? So Eric, what is your take on tariffs?
Well, first of all, I think Paul Krugman has one of the best quotes of all time for an economist, which is elections decide who has the power, not who has the knowledge. And yep. I absolutely love that quote because I believe politics is an unwilling participant in economics. When I first started my job, I used to think economics is an unwilling participant in politics, but I found out it was the opposite. No, I mean, the thing about it is we can't look at tariffs. First off, on the trade deficit side, I hear that. That's a question I get asked a lot. It's actually a question I got asked last year during my outlook. And my response to that is, we're the richest country on earth. Who are we trading with?
Yeah,
that's exactly. And that's why when it's always got a negative connotation, right? And I've never really understood that. If you've spent, and I'm a fair weather econ reader, I have been for years, but I'm more of like I love to read about game theory and stuff like that. But in general, when it comes to econ, trade deficits kind of have a negative connotation, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about it, same thing with tariffs, is that it's not binary. Depends what your trade deficit is and what your, you know, if you have a trade surplus. Like China's trade surplus right now is horribly problematic. The US's trade deficit right now is to be expected. Unless we start trading with some sort of like richer alien planet, there's nobody richer to trade with. So we're going to have a deficit. That's very weird. Surprising, rich people spend more money. Rich countries spend more money.
Right.
Which is, you would think that would be common sense, but.
There's an old expression that economics is common sense in a language we don't understand.
Yeah.
I was like that one. Yeah, I mean, tariffs are defined. If you're doing it, if you're a protectionary tariff and you're just, you know, passing a tariff on, I know, Kyle, you know this industry. Like, yeah, I think we were having some Mexican food up in my neck of the woods when we were discussing U.S. steel.
That's right.
Yeah, but you're just putting a tariff on, you know, the importation of steel because you want to protect steel jobs. Well, you know, surprise, you're not going to protect steel. You're not protecting U.S. jobs. You may protect steel jobs, but you're going to, you know, you'll put keg makers out of business, which is what we saw happen to Pennsylvania, you know, a little over five-ish years ago. But if you're applying tariffs, like, say, to electric cars, which is something the Trump administration and the Biden administration did, and preview, I'll be talking about that on December 4th at Gray, Gray, and Gray. That's a good idea because you're like right now, my students are currently on externalities, negative externalities, and how you adjust for marginal social cost. If you have a country like China that has very, very restricted domestic consumption because it underpays its workers, and so it's underpaying its workers to produce cheaper goods, and those cheaper goods are meant to devastate markets. They're meant to, you know, reduce the amount of capital return you can get for investing in the production function of a market, and by reducing that return, you essentially inhibit the development of that market. And once you salt the land good enough, you can exploit, you know, being a monopoly or being an oligopoly, depending on how you look at it. If you look at nationwide, it's monopoly. If you look at it firm wide, it's oligopolistic.
Mm-hmm.
So Demers. What you can
sorry.
So what you can do is that, you know, you can pass tariffs to impute the correct cost. So a tariff that's meant to correct a subsidy from a foreign nation is a good tool in a lot of cases. A tariff meant to, and I say this in quotation marks, protect jobs rarely does that. But if you say it costs $10,000 to produce an electric vehicle, and China's suppression of wages, you know, makes it that, you know, it can be sold in the United States for $7,500. Well, if the U.S. comes in and applies a $2,500 tariff to that to correct it back up to $10,000, you're actually replicating more of a free market, even though you're using tariffs. But if, you know, Japan's producing steel at, Kyle, how do you measure steel? What is the unit of bushel of steel?
It's tons okay. per annum.
Okay, so if you're doing it based, say it's, you know, $5,000 a ton, and, you know, Japan can produce it for $4,000, and that's just free market. It's not subsidization by the Japanese government. You're not saving jobs by suddenly, like, just charging $1,000 on top of, you know, Japanese steel.
I wish we would have gotten that price for steel when I was in. Our bonus would have been huge.
give me the price of steel. I don't know.
I mean, I want to say, like, we're typically selling, like, rebar for somewhere between, like, $800 to $900 a ton, depending on the price of scrap. Like, if you look at the price of scrap, scrap is typically around, like $200 to $500 a ton. So value add to that is going to be about 25%.
So you're telling me for a mere $900, I can have one of my friends get 2,000 pounds of rebar dropped off in their front yard?
I mean, how much does it cost to pour a foundation? Probably not that expensive,
probably
right?
Not that expensive, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, the economics of steel.
Yes.
What were we talking about? Tariffs? Oh, you're talking about tariffs and steel tariffs as your example.
I think the interesting thing that you pointed out is that it's there to mimic more of a free market because of a foreign market that can sell it cheaper to us. So that's interesting thing.
How many European countries have subsidies to, like, stimulate the growth? Like, a lot of steel manufacturing in Europe, isn't that subsidized?
Yeah, I believe so. You see pretty large cross-subsidization in Europe. That's part of, like, kind of that Keynesian structure. And I do want to make a point of clarification. If a nation can produce something cheaper, that's good. That's a comparative advantage, right? That's why trade works. That's why one of the biggest things I have to teach my students is that economics is not a zero-sum game. Everybody can do better in a capitalistic market. So if they're just producing it cheaper, that's fine. But it's when there's government intervention that's suppressing the rate, which is what, like, happens in China. Then you should have a corrective tariff, we'd call it, that just brings that cost closer to market equilibrium. If a country should produce something cheaper, that's a good thing. Like, it's nice that bananas, like, don't cost anything. that's a big reason.
But if the government's subsidizing something and tariffs get put on it, what's the point of even subsidizing it anymore at that point?
Oh, it's a pissing match. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, pissing match is always on the table, Kyle. the reason you can't buy a Toyota Hilux is because, like, the freaking West Germans weren't buying enough, like, chicken under LBJ. They're like, we're going to give you a tariff. I mean, my favorite thing in the world is that we have all these sin taxes, which, you know, is a restrictive policy on tobacco, and the U.S. government subsidizes tobacco farmers to make up for that tax. Oh yeah, that's always a weird one to start explaining in class. Like, wait a minute, like, especially with, like, younger kids who went through, like, the anti-vape and all that stuff. Like, wait a minute, the guy in, like, North Carolina growing tobacco is getting, like, it's about $60 million a year they spend in subsidies tobacco farms.
Do they also get paid to not grow other crops too, then?
Well, I mean, but isn't that what happens, right? Because, like, if the opportunity cost of your land suddenly becomes a lot higher if the government's subsidizing on top of it. Mm-hmm. So we have mountains full of cheese, too. We just have, like, underground storage of just, like, billions of pounds of cheese. Because they were like, World War II ended, and now we don't need this much milk. But, like, the dairy farmers want milk, need to sell their milk. We don't want that to, like, collapse. So, guess the government's in the milk buying business, and some dude's like, dude, this milk is going bad really fast. Like, cheese. I'm not joking. That's a real thing. Yeah.
How much? So, we have a strategic reserve of cheese?
I don't know how strategic it is.
it would be recognized as strategic at this point.
I would call it that.
Agreed, White Boy.
We need to bribe France to help out with Israel and Iran. I mean, maybe that's where we use that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think Israel's a huge fan. I don't think France is a huge fan of Israel.
Like, no, they're not, but they love cheese.
The Israelis stole a friend. I'm not going to get too deep down this road, but the Israelis decades ago stole a boat. No, they had boats built by the French. There was an issue in Lebanon. I can't remember if it was a war. Maybe it was a war, maybe a blockade or something. So I'm not trying to trivialize that. I actually don't remember what it was. And so the Israelis pretended to be Norwegians and, like, snuck onto the ships that were made in France and, like, drove them back to Israel. And as they were passing the Strait of Gibraltar, the Brits were like, yo, like, hey, who are you? What are you guys doing? And a helicopter, they didn't respond back because they didn't want, like, the French to know. Right. So the Brits threw a helicopter off Gibraltar and saw they were obviously Israeli ships and flew back. And they Morse code with the light back, bon voyage. I'm like, the greatest beef in history, the Brits versus the French, even when they're on the same side. Yeah. They're not on the same side. Record, those are two NATO countries, and one of those NATO countries had a military boat stolen from it, and the other response was like, dude, have a good trip.
they troll them as they get their boat stolen. Yeah.
That's fucking hilarious.
Yeah. No, but I mean, like that's the thing. And Rick, you hit it. I mean, I feel like traders understand this better than anybody else, like trading between two nations. Like it is no different than two individuals trading. We try to make, like, economics is like esoteric fields. Like, you have to understand global politics. What do you mean you can't point out Azerbaijan on a map? It's like, no, man, like, a rich person spends more money. A rich person's going to have a bigger trade deficit because they're simply buying more volume. And then once you get to the top of that list, that person at the top has nobody who has more money than him to trade with. The U.S. is comically ahead of everybody else. Even economies that rival us, which there really isn't, because China's economy is like, everybody's like, oh, it's almost our size. It's like, it's not.
It's not. It's actually not at all. It's not even remotely close.
Yeah. It's like, nah, man, Japan is still, like, the closest thing we ever had to a competitor in, like, modern times.
And still, really?
Yeah, honestly, it is. Because they're an advanced economy on top of, like, you know, they are really, really developed. I mean, they just, like, don't want immigration, and it's destroying their economy.
They were, we talked about, like, China and the way they steal tech, and they never actually innovate. Yeah. I feel like Japan kind of went down that same route post-World War II, but they actually learned how to, you know, do it, too. They weren't just relying on stealing it.
Yeah, I was reading this, I forget her name, but she's an awesome economist. If I remember it, Kyle, if I can dig it up, I'll forward it to you to throw in the description.
The one we talked about a couple weeks ago?
It could have been. If you've heard me on this rant before, where, like, the cool thing about Japan is that they may not be the best inventors, but like they're amazing at innovating.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And then they're like,
they take it, make it way better.
Way better. Yep. And then they're like boys with like the US tech sector. And they're like, oh, okay, we'll just like get together and make amazing things. So one of my favorite facts of all time is that there's only two first world nations with a population over 100 million. 22. With the US?
Yeah.
The US and Japan.
So, is Japan over 100 million?
Dude, like Japan's like 190 million. Yeah, it's way bigger than you think it is. Yeah, dude, it's wild. Do they do like public apologies and they have to raise prices? It's like
pretty much. I mean, that's why it's always fun to when they end up in the news and they're talking about manipulating the upper band of the interest rates, because it's like they're always sad about it. It's like you guys have had 0% or negative interest rates for the better part of a decade and a half, and you're like still trying to hold on for dear life. And honestly, that's another topic in and of itself to talk about, is Japan and how they still function as an economy and what how they're able to do what they're doing.
You guys listen to Hardcore History, Dan Carlin?
Yeah.
He did like a 5-part series on Japan and the turnaround that they did after World War II. That was a fascinating series.
It is super fascinating. And even so, that's like another one. Like that's kind of one where how were they able to hold their interest rates negative and not have rampant hyperinflation like the 80s? That's something that I've never understood.
Was the other country you told me that never had to raise their interest rate? Was it Switzerland?
Yeah, Switzerland like doesn't. They have net inflation. Their inflation's average like 1.5%.
Holy crap, that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, inflation's also a product of consumption. So if you're like in Japan and you have a society that's like very, you know, for lack of a better word, is like very conservative in how they spend money.
You actually that would make sense.
Prevent inflation. Also, Japan has a very weird housing stock. I mean, you guys know this about Japan, like how their housing stock works?
No.
Well, they built up, right? Because they have like their like geography is so tiny over there.
Yeah, just like garbage geography. But most freestanding single residencies aren't worth anything. Like you can literally buy houses in Japan for like $0.
Really?
Yeah, because they fall apart. Like they not fall apart like material wise. I mean, like
ground.
Yeah, so the ground stinks and the earthquakes eventually take so much damage on a house. It's actually not like the massive earthquake that would like. You know, is what you're thinking, which obviously does a lot of damage. Don't get me wrong.
Those slow and rolling shock ones that happen all the time.
Yeah, it's basically the CTE of home construction. I don't know if that was insensitive.
Maybe, but that's going to be a quote.
Yeah. But yeah, so then,
the CTE ESPN. Shout out Antonio Brown.
Yeah, so they end up, the houses end up basically depreciating so quickly. And so that creates like some really interesting economic phenomenon, because, you know, what's the average person's biggest investment?
Their house.
Right.
So like what happens when like your house is actually your biggest depreciation? Like there it almost creates an environment where rent is the only thing. You're either renting it from yourself, which if there's a negative interest rate, you guys are traders and you're way smarter than me. But if there's a negative interest rate and you essentially are renting your house from yourself, doesn't a negative interest rate help you, right? Because like the dollar, it's weakening over time.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That makes more sense.
Is that why the market's been so stagnant over the last 50 years?
It has
years?
To be. Because so and also it's that, and it has to, I would assume it's that. And then, like you said, they've got an extremely conservative culture and they like to run, they like to work themselves ragged. So they don't even have time to spend. Yeah,
worse
money.
Than us.
Oh, yeah. It's terrible.
Yeah, then you can add in some other stuff that makes it Japan really interesting, which is like, you know, you can have like what we're seeing in Canada right now, which is like Canada's GDP is growing.
But the you doing research for our upcoming Canada?
Oh, I am. Joel and I are gonna have some fun. By the way, thanks for that YouTube short of me. Like, I feel like Canadians would like that short.
I think so. I would hope so.
I'm a very big fan of Canadians. Just like the country in general, it's very very pro Canada. Yeah, so like one of the weird parts you see that's happening in Japan, and you're kind of seeing it on steroids compared to, you know, what's happening in Canada, but Canada finally ticked over that edge, is that you're seeing GDP growth, but you're seeing per capita GDP decline. And Japan's the opposite of that, where you're seeing relatively stagnant GDP changes, but their population's aging and falling out so fast that you're seeing GDP per capita growth. But
yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about that.
That's true.
Because like you said, that's just that nice basic algebraic equation from GDP with what's all combined into it. But it's really like you start to chip away at like the kind of the elements of it. If you have a reduced population, your GDP is going to go up. Like if it's not filling as much. Mm-hmm. So that can be kind of, I mean, wouldn't you say that at that point, it's giving a false sense of a healthy report for a country that might not be there?
Yeah, I think that, and Rick, you hit a home run early on in this when you said, like, you know, isn't this common sense in a lot of parts? And one of the things that makes it economics inherently hard is that it's so nuanced. That's why I don't talk about economics on Reddit, because you just can't have a nuanced explanation with with anybody there. It's just like, no, everything is this or that. It's like, no, there's a gray area. It's like, what do you know? It's like, well, I teach economics and I have a master's degree in it. And I like to think I have a fairly good job that involves a lot of economics, but I mean, like, yeah, no, screw me. That's right. As I click on your profile and see your top communities are all like the most disgusting subreddits in the world. I'm like, no, it's fine. It's just,
when we get back to, are you a Keynesian? Or are you an Austrian? That's when we can truly harmonize in economics again. Because I thought like that was literally like the thing. Everybody just kind of went back and forth as if they were Austrians or Keynesians. And that seminal book was fucking amazing. Pardon my language. But anyways, that was like awesome to read how those two kind of went back and forth in general when it came to economics. And that was also kind of coming around the time when theoretical physics was proving out the theory of general relativity. So then if you think about it, that's when all the economists wanted to do the same thing.
Yeah. And then obviously Hitler throwing out a bunch of economists of Jewish descent, and they all end up fleeing to the US and England. I mean, like, that's how Keynes and Hayek became like really, really, really good friends. And it's wild to think how combative those two. I mean, like, I found myself, I'm an Austrian. I'm an Austrian who loves econometrics. I mean, I was on Harris School of Business podcast maybe like a month ago, and I was like, this is one of my dreams, because obviously, like, being an Austrian, I love the Chicago school. It's not like I'm not a full Chicago guy, which I don't think there's anybody who, you should ever read one full economic system or economic viewpoint.
I agree with that.
Like, I love Austrianism, but it's heterodoxic in nature, and it's not, you know, it's not a field that loves econometrics. And I'm somebody who loves econometrics. I love mathematical application of looking for the truth. But my viewpoint in the world is very, very, very Austrian. But, like, I don't know. I see people calling Keynesians socialist. I'm like, not freaking socialist. Are you kidding me? Keynesians not socialist.
Is that like in reference to their fiscal stimulus? Is that what they're trying to say?
Yeah. Well, they'll point out stuff like, oh, Norway is a socialist nation. I'm like, no, they're not. You have to own the means of production. That is the only way you become a socialist nation. Redistribution of wealth is not inherently mean you have a socialist economy. Do all socialistic economies redistribute wealth? Yes, they do. That's a hallmark of it. But like using tax dollars from, you know, taxing privately owned capital and then giving it to, you know, lower income individuals is a form of redistribution of wealth. But that's not inherently mean they're socialistic, because private industry still owns the vast majority of means of production. Norway's weird, because they did that thing where they let, you know, people build like dams and different infrastructure for 50 years, and it became owned by the state.
They also had that thing with the speeding tickets where it's based on your net worth.
Yeah, as an economist, I low key am like, I don't want that, but also that's how you should do that.
Makes sense.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and. But, you know, you guys know this. You get something that, you get infrastructure that's 50 years old, it's depreciated to zero. You're not really, damaging your capital stack in that standpoint. I'll sit there and be like, no, like, you know, you take, I don't want to say their names, you take presidential candidates, and I'm like, they're not socialists. They're Keynesians. They don't believe the government should, they're not advocating for privatization. It's not Alamo down in Mexico being like, let's take over the oil again. It's like, that never worked. That has worked zero out of all the times.
How many times has Venezuela done that?
Yeah.
Oh, man, look at their economy. It's just decimated.
Dude, one of my favorite things is like, you know, you've, you know, people who immigrate from Venezuela to the U.S. and are just like, oh, wait, you guys, like, A, the average American does not, like, they don't know who Maduro is. They don't, they're not evil. They don't hate us. Like I've heard Venezuelans say.
Right.
Like, oh, cool, you're from Venezuela. Like, they're pumped to see you. He's like, oh, my God, you guys are supposed to be the enemy, like, hurting us. In reality, it's like, hey, can you have free elections and, like, stop, like, causing migrant crisis and giving oil to, like dangerous nations? And they're like, oh, well, no. It's like, okay, well, we're going to sanction you. And it's like, I always hate that. You have these true socialistic nations, right? Mm-hmm. And they complain about, like, oh, the U.S. is hurting our economy. The U.S. is hurting our economy. It's like, if your system's so well, you shouldn't have to rely on us. Like, if your system works,
right,
it should work without capitalism. That's like, I keep seeing all these cars driving around Massachusetts, and they have EV license plates. And so they get to ride, like, the HOV lane and all that stuff. And they have, like, dual mufflers. It doesn't count if you're a hybrid vehicle. You're just, like, adding one more step to just being a fossil fuel vehicle. Like, that's not – I want the guy, the Chevy Bolt and the Tesla. He can have an EV license plate. But, like, I see Jeep Wranglers, like, the 4xE, and I'm like, your brick is, like, most un-aerodynamic, un-aerodynamic vehicle in the world. And you get like, oh, no, because I'm charging a battery with the fuel I'm burning, that's an electric vehicle. It's okay. I mean, for that logic, like, everything's an electric vehicle.
Wait, my car is. Yeah. That's what the alternator does.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, Just, sorry, that's nothing to do with economics, but it's very, very frustrating to me. But no, I felt like that's like America's mean to Cuba because they don't trade with them. It's like, yeah, but we're not stopping. Like, yeah, there's sanctions on Cuba, but like, if your system's so well, how did you fall apart immediately? Like, how did you immediately fall apart? Maybe your system's not great.
Maybe pick a different side.
Yeah, one of the funny things is, like, you know, having students, and I have some, like, wicked advanced heights. So I was talking last time I was on, like, I love, like, the students I have. They're so smart. They just, it's a blast to have them. And I have some very smart high school kids. And, like,
liar. Who,
no, they are, like, I remember myself when I was in high school, and I'm like, oh, my God, these kids are just so much smarter than me. I can't wait till, like, in 3 months.
20 years from now to see. No, 20 years to see what. Oh, God. I want to see what happens. What's the next, you know, who's going to found the first company on Mars? That's what I'm excited to see.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope we, like, clean that up better. I don't want that to be like the Dutch trading company or something like that.
Oh, man. Can you imagine?
It was a fun game, at least.
The Netherlands are like, so we have a space program. It's like, no, you don't. It's like, oh, okay.
Dude, how did I was looking a little bit deeper into that because after visiting you guys, like, seeing, like, more about the pilgrims and, like, the journey they made over here. I didn't realize that they spent so much time in Holland before leaving up to here. And I'd looking and digging into Holland, you see that they were very open to immigration. They were very open with the way you could, you know, freedom of religion, freedom. They were very much kind of like us. Like, they had the kind of the same blueprint of that. And I was wondering if that was why they became such an economic powerhouse.
Yeah, that and telling, like, hey, traders, here's a bunch of firearms too. Like,
okay, that might have had something to do with it.
No, like, there's some countries I'm just like, oh, we think they're great and all, but, like, people are like, oh, Belgium's such a sophisticated country. I'm like, just Google, like, Leopoldville. Just like,
what is it?
Leopoldville. Like, Belgium just, like, the King Leopold.
Who just massacred the Congo, wasn't it? Or tried to?
Yeah, he was like, oh, you didn't harvest enough rubber, cutting off your fingers.
Yep.
Yeah, that's like that happened, like, as recent as there's photos of it. Like, there's, like, people were like, oh, I'm going to take, like, photos of this. It's a recent
1966 is when it was renamed.
Yeah, yeah, it's horrible. But yeah, you have all these, like, nice, like, European nations. Everybody's like, oh, they're so sweet. It's like, no, they're awful. Like, dude.
France and Africa was pretty fucking... just horrible. Disgusting too, yeah.
Yeah, still horrible. I mean, you charge a nation, they charge nations to use the Central African franc. Like, they charge them 5% of their holdings or something like that to use
for their own currency.
Yeah, and then you have like Spain was like straight up actual fascist, like within living memory. It's like, oh, what's older, non-fascist Spain or like a CD player, the Walkman? It's like the Walkman's older.
The Walkman is from 1991 is when it first came out. So yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah, then like you ask like the Spanish, like, hey, how are the Basque region? It's like, oh, they fought, like, they treat them like they're insurgents.
Hmm.
Like, yeah, so like most of language in Europe is Indo-European, naturally. Yeah. Like, except the Basque language is like unique. It's not a Semitic language, not Indo-European. It's like its own speech. And like they're essentially eradicating that entire language and culture. And people are just like, oh no, Spain's a great, we should be more like Spain. It's like Spain is 60% poorer than Mississippi. And they're currently practicing, you know, it's like they're currently just destroying an entire
basically genocide.
Yeah, yes. Like you call it cultural genocide. Oh, and then like all of southern Spain is like, no, never, like, never ask a European where they get their fruit, because like they just basically have a slave system and they have these giant like tarped areas where they grow all their fruit. And it's like, wow. Oh, you guys, I love that. I love, one of my favorite things is Europeans will be like, well, we have a better rail system. It's like, okay, but do you know why Kansas has oranges that are cheaper than being in freaking Rotterdam? It's because we prioritize freight. And so you end up having a lot cheaper food. And cheaper food, I'm going to throw this out, controversial. If you're poor, cheaper food's better. And Europe's a lot poorer than the United States. Yeah, so you end up with like, oh, yeah, it's just like all of Europe, the more you like, they're one of those things where they like very shiny on the surface and then you rub it a little bit and you're like, oh, what the hell's going on over there?
Greece, what are you doing to the euro?
Yeah, or like, or like Norway is just like, I'm always like, if everybody's like, oh, what a peaceful, beautiful area. And like, why can't we be more like Norway? And I always tell me like, you can't do the Norway model everywhere. It's like, oh, why? Because we're not like unified enough or intelligent. I'm like, no, because you don't export enough oil. They have the dirtiest economy. In class, I always use the example of like negative externalities. I'm like, yeah, Norway's the king of it. Norway has 5.5 million people. That's a million people less than just the state of Massachusetts. And they, like, 37% of all their exports are oil and hydrocarbons. And they just pollute the crap out of the rest of the world. Take that revenue, put it in the Norway Sovereign Wealth Fund, which, hey, they're pretty successful at managing it. But right. I'm always like, oh, if they took climate change remotely serious, their economy would collapse overnight.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, no.
And my favorite one is somebody who's like, well, what's the next biggest industry? Industrial fishing. I'm like, you're too big at 50% of your economy. It's like the two worst things for the environment. Like, oh, crap. That's also a no-go. Yeah, so it's like very funny.
At least it's not whaling anymore.
It did. Well, yeah, up until last year or something.
Yeah, right.
Like obscure like that. They just decided because they knew that they were overfishing whales.
Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue. Chumba. Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com. VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Is it over fishing whales or over whaling whales?
Over whaling, I would have to say.
Another question. Computer mouses or computer mice?
I think it's mouses.
I think so too.
Okay. Sometimes I tell my interns, like, oh, we need to go to computer mice, and it's very fun to see if they'll correct me.
It's fun to say it, yeah. It's also fun to throw out fishes as the plural, because most people don't realize that that's actually the correct way to do it.
Yes, really? Also, the plural of octopus is octopodes, because it has a Greek derivative.
Well, okay.
Didn't know that.
All right, so, now that we just lost the last person who was listening.
Somebody just shows up and fights me. Because I'm pretty sure it's also acceptable to use octopi and octopuses. But I was like, it's a Greek root, so it's octopodes.
The only one I know is octopussy, and that's from James Bond.
James Bond.
But yeah, Norway, piece of crap export nation that just pollutes the world. And everybody's like, we should be more like them. I'm like, yeah, but you can't expand resources with populations. Like, dude, for a country with 350 million people, we're doing a good job.
Why did the EU fall apart so much? Is just trying to smash that many cultures into one umbrella?
I mean, they've been fighting each other nonstop for like 1,000 years. They're like, oh, so I'll get together and be friends. It's like, how long? What do you think is going to happen? Guys, well, we literally fought the bloodiest war in human history, like 5 decades ago. And now you're trying to like all be boys? Like,
and you did it again, like 10 years later.
Yeah.
Well, think about it. They got split right down the middle. They even decided to hang Mussolini in the fucking public square. And I mean, like, yeah, to say all of a sudden, like, hey, let's let bygones be bygones. It's like, yeah, right.
I was impressed when I visited Italy that there seemed to still be an appetite for or a desire to elect fascists. Like, fascism was still pretty strong in Italy when I was there. They had a wine shop that was selling the Führer wine that had a picture of Hitler on it.
Oh my God. Yeah.
You know the prime minister of Italy is Mussolini's granddaughter, right?
Oh my God, no.
Yeah.
No, that's who the prime minister
is. Oh my God.
That's the prime minister of Italy right now.
My God.
That sounds made up.
It does.
It's not, because wasn't like it was, I remember hearing about that, and then think about France. France is just an absolute dumpster fire of a country too. They had the, what was it, the IMF. And remember when we were going to talk with Eric about France too?
Yeah.
And I remember looking into it a little bit, and I was just like, wow, you guys really are something special, because they said that the IMF went out and said that your guys' GDP projections are wrong. You need to cut your deficit. And they're like, no, it'll work itself out. And then the IMF comes back, goes, no, we did the numbers. They're wrong. France goes back and goes, no, it will work out. We promise.
And then they
wink, and it's like, okay, so now we've got, they're going to default on all of their loans. All their bonds are going to be worthless, just like the time that it happened in Russia. And it's like France. And then right after that, that was when they had that snap election and wanted to get rid of Macron.
Oh God, they had that snap election right after Eric told us about the, what was that line you gave us? France is on their fourth republic in the last 100 years.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's true, because it's just like, holy moly.
Yeah, my dad just celebrated his birthday, and he is older by a year than the current French government. Like, it was 1958. Very recent. I tried to be this guy, but like, yeah, it was very, very recent. Yeah, France is wild.
They're probably the more wild country I've read about.
Yeah, because they come off as like very metropolitan. Like, most of France is empty. You guys know that, right? Like, you go north, southwest from Paris, it's pretty much, until you hit the Basque region of Spain, it's like just an empty country. It's like one line of people. It gives you the I think it's the funnest geography fact of all time, which is the largest park in the EU is in South America. French Ghana.
Oh my God.
Talk about a place that escaped decolonialism, right?
Right.
Yeah, no, we're just going to keep the Maldives And we got to keep French Guiana because we need the European Space Agency.
Well, because they called it French Guiana. I think that was the mistake because the other Guiana got free.
Yeah, and I think it's, yeah, I mean, that's also why, like, they own all my French fries, too, because they're just a shit joke. I'm sorry, Kyle. You're better than that. You expect more from me, and you should hold me to higher standard. But do you guys remember during the 2000, I think it was in, well, it was 2007, 2008 recession, but I think it was in 2009, Greece was doing its bailout. Do you remember, yeah. Do you remember what the prime minister of Greece said to Germany?
Mm-mm. No.
Germany was lecturing them on how they spent, right? And he said, there's many people in Athens who still do not like hearing a German accent. Like, oh, yeah, because you were occupied by, like, your uncles and grandparents. Like,
right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, like, yeah, this is 2009. Like, yeah.
And yeah. Why did the EU not work?
Yeah, right. Oh, my favorite part.
2009, and they're saying that. That's 2009. Wild.
Like, one of the weird parts about, like, Greece joining the EU was wild to me because Greece doesn't tax normally. I don't know if you guys know this, but Greece passively, it's not official government policy, uses something called an inflationary tax. So, like, they use your seniorage. So, they just go out, they don't collect taxes. They're very bad at collecting taxes. There's a very famous study on the pool tax of Greece where you have to pay a tax to have a pool. Somebody flies over Athens and, like, you know, it's like less than 1% of the pools are paying taxes. So, what Greece did for literally probably since, like, you know, Athens and Sparta are around, they did this by devaluing their currency, but they would just print more money. They'd do seniorage. So they would just be like, all right, we need, you know, 15% of the GDP to pay for government, right? And they would just print more money and pay for it, and then everybody's money would become worth a little less.
Sounds like a brilliant plan.
Yeah, it's not super cool if you like businesses or prosperity.
Yeah, it's not necessarily going to drive capitalism.
Yeah. Then what are you doing? Like, oh, my neighbor to the east, I'm constantly arguing with him. He's like, you just don't get along. It's very bizarre that we're like, if you have like your list of like next wars to break out, like top five is definitely like between two NATO countries. So like Greece and Turkey, you just like don't like each other. That's how combined the U.S., that's how scary the U.S. military is. It's like, you two are going to like each other. It's like, we've been at war forever. It's like, yeah, that's cool. I'm watching you. Like, you like, all right, I guess we'll join. Sorry, Mr. US. Number one on my list is Egypt versus Ethiopia. Is gonna be the next war.
Ethiopia.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
So they built like a lot of
I know Ethiopia's had a lot of shit, but I didn't know Egypt was involved in that.
Yeah, so like, yeah, you guys know what's going on in Ethiopia. It's horrible right now, dude. Like, you know, I think the capital city is currently under the quick response force.
Yeah, it's like military ran right now, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I was taking a drink.
Which is terrible because we have, like, from where I'm from, a huge Sudanese population, and the Lost Boys, and then Ethiopians. Yeah, dude, so like, Lost Boys. Yeah, there you go. You want to talk?
Dude, that's talk so about... sad. I wrote a paper about that in college. I was like, this is the single saddest thing I've ever.
I worked.
Are you just talking about the movies from the 80s?
No, so it's basically in Sudan. They have had a religious war going on between north and the south for years. And at one point in time, there was north came into south and burned down a village. And all these boys were basically running across the desert and getting eaten by lions and all that stuff. Jesus. They don't know what their names are. They don't know how old they are. I mean, I knew like four or five of them, and it was like really, really bad. I mean, so naturally, like, you get your diversity visa, you come to the United States, they come and live up here because of we've got a big industrial hub. And then like a lot of times, you know, they're all Christian, and they are like 90% of them, I would have to say, are Christian because they're being persecuted in their country by Muslims. And then they come to another country that's got more of a Christian population than a Muslim population. So they kind of, I mean, I know that this is going to sound kind of weird, but they fit in really well in Minnesota. Hmm. And there's a reason for that. That's because they have the same ideals and basically a lot of the same beliefs as the population. So you've got a massive Sudanese population and a massive Norwegian population. Norwegians are historically, you know, Protestant Christian, and so are the Sudanese. So of course they're going to end up getting along and basically being having the same types of ideals and values. So the Lost Boys is a wild one, especially with how bad Africa is in general.
Yeah,
and I mean,
there's
go ahead.
I was going to say there's a great documentary on Netflix. It came out decades ago. Called Lost Boys that actually follows some of the South Sudanese, and dude, just there's a scene. Like, listen, I think America is the best country on earth. I don't think it's close. I think we have problems, but I think just if you take every individual issue, I think the way we work on solving it, and you add that up, I think we do a good job.
We also talk about them too, as you pointed out.
Yeah, we do talk about them, which I don't know why we get yelled at for talking about them.
I know, right?
Dude, there's a scene where they go to a grocery store for the first time.
Oh God!
I have friends who have fled very horrible situations. That's a cool thing about economics. You meet people from all over the world. Every one of them talks about going to a grocery store as being like the most like they can't like. I have a very good friend who's Venezuelan, and he was just like, you almost don't know what to make. He goes, it seems like imaginary because you know they exist and you hear them in media, and the U.S. is so culturally dominant throughout the rest of the world that they have an idea about it. Like, they're like, oh, we're going to go in there. And they're like, oh my God, you guys can just pick food from all around the world and it's cheap and you can just like, you can eat whatever you want. I have a buddy from Libya who said the same thing. He's like, yeah, it's overwhelming the first time you go in, but it's awesome. That scene's amazing because the Sudanese come in and they're like they're going to a bakery. They're like, what? Like, imagine like seeing a donut for the first time. It must be a weird thing. And
the guy, or just like, the fruit and like not knowing what a banana is or whatever.
Like, and they just like give them a donut and they're like, this is like unbelievable. You just like give me this. I mean, when Khrushchev came to the United States, he saw a grocery store and was like, oh, I screwed up my people.
that's how it went. Oh, shit. I was going to say that. That's exactly what I was going to say is that the grocery store effect, that's how the fall of the communist revolution in Russia basically went to shit, because he's like, holy crap, there's stuff on the shelves in the stores here. And he turned and he was like, yeah, we're done with this. And that was when it just all was done right after that.
Yeah.
Dude, I love that scene in that movie. Oh God, what was that one of the guy from MASH where he tries to start the Cold War with Canada, Canadian Bacon.
What did you just say? It sounds awesome.
Never seen Canadian Bacon?
No.
Oh, okay. So the guy tries to start a Cold War with Russia. He tries to get it going again because he's running for re-election. He doesn't want to lose. So he calls up I think it was Gorbachev, or I don't know who it was at the time, but he calls the guy up and like he flies in. They're over at, Camp David or whatever. And he's talking to the guy. He's like, hey, you want to get the thing going again? You know, that was fun all times, right? And the Russian guy's just sitting there with a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken munching on it. Like, no, you guys won. This is good. We're good.
No, but we did win. We won so emphatically.
And yeah.
I was mentioning this a little earlier. Like, I have to like stop myself because like, I have office hours during the week. And undoubtedly... within those 2 hours, I will go off on a 20-minute tangent of being how dumb communism is. And like, it's because I'm teaching the kids stuff and I'm like, oh, this is why this works this way. And this is why communism is stupid, because it doesn't acknowledge this fact. I mean, like, I don't know, Karl Marx was financially supported by a very wealthy British aristocrat and had to pawn his pants in order to feed his family. And like, we're taking financial advice from that dude.
And also, he got installed in Russia by Germany, who was just trying to close off the front in World War One.
That was Lenin, really? Which is, again, adds to more people, more like, these people are just tools.
Yeah.
The best thing is every year on May Day, the Economist, it's called the Economist magazine, but it's actually considered itself a newspaper because it was originally a newspaper the first like 150 years of its publication. They're so old that Karl Marx used to write into them, and they used to just make fun of him, and they republish all of them. They are so mean. It is the funniest thing in the world, because it's not like they're like, oh, we have a difference. Because I'm a subscriber to The Economist, all right? You're reading The Economist, people are like, oh, hoity-toity. And you forget that it used to just be a bunch of, like, neoliberals in the, like in the 1800s, just being like, how about you let people do whatever the hell they want, and we let the economy work that way? And Karl Marx would be like, I'm going to tell you a story about a bread maker. It's like, no, Carl, if you don't own pants, you don't get to have an opinion on the economy.
What is this on?
The Economist.
The Economist.com?
Okay. Yeah, it's an actual magazine. And it's actually pretty cool to read.
Yeah, let's see if I can find that online.
I used to read that after I discovered Noah Smith, who's a nice pundit when it comes to economics, too, that I'm sure you've heard of.
Yeah, Noah Smith's pissa. Yeah. Yeah, so I subscribe to that. I'll just bring like a giant, it's really funny. So like, I'll bring a giant stack. Like, I'll just have them at work, right? Because like, I read them, and it's not like, yeah, what, there's two people in my house. I mean, it's not going to be read. So I'll throw them on like a chair. I used to have a huge stack of them on one of the like little end tables in my office. And our solicitor for the city, I love him. Fucking brilliant guy, dude. Like, Brown graduate, all that stuff. He had to go to court one day because, you know, city solicitor, and you can't bring cell phones and stuff. And he's like, can I take some of these? And I was like, yeah, I don't give a crap. And he's like, I haven't read this in years. He goes, I forgot, because you're so used to, like, the articles you normally see from The Economist are very serious, that you forget that, like, half the magazine is essentially, like, ultra-smart people trying to, like, not intentionally being funny, but just, like, calling out very stupid things. And he's like, I'm sitting there in court reading it. I'm like, I thought this was, like, super entertaining. Like, I'm like, oh, yeah, it is one of those funny things where people say, like, The Economist, and it's, like, great magazine, great publication. And their feature articles are are better than articles a lot of times you'd read in, like, a professional journal. But then you add on the fact that, like, it's, like, a, you know, 60-page magazine. So this kind of stuff that people are just like, we're going to cover a topic, but they're going to talk very, like, openly and opinionated about it. And they can't help but be, like, super sarcastic. I'm like, oh, who would have guessed making peanuts illegal meant there was no more peanut butter? Like, oh, this is impossible. Who would have guessed that?
Who could have thought of that?
It sounds like the Sierra Chart support board, kind of.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's exactly right. So they're pretty much very, very similar, except if you're an actual economist and serious, they'll just pull your pants down and push you over and laugh at you.
I think one of the... I forget how many, a few years ago, I was reading a great article in there, and I'll dig it up because I probably haven't bookmarked it, but because I send it out all the time. But they were basically talking about like Wagyu beef. Oh, going back to Japan, they were talking about like Kobe beef, and they were comparing it to like, they were comparing it to bourbon, to Kentucky bourbon. Like, what makes bourbon? Oh, I'd ask him for Bourbon County, Kentucky, it'd be 51% corn mash, would be, you know, aged for 2 years in a barrel. In a white oak barrel. And they were talking about, like, you know, the rise of Wagyu and Kobe beef and, like, how people can't differentiate, don't know the difference between them. And mm-hmm. like, you can have Kobe beef and you can have Wagyu. And Wagyu is, like, pretty much, I think, like, the breed of cow, and Kobe's, like, would be, like, the bourbon. Like, Wagyu's whiskey, Kobe is bourbon.
Wagyu can come from, like, South America, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it
Kobe
was,
cannot, yeah.
Yeah, and it was the funniest thing. Because the guy's like, oh, you created all this false demand. And then a bunch of, like, lower-income countries were like, oh, I can just get rid of the Red Angus cows that I have and get these. And people were like, oh, no, you can't export the cows. And it was just, like, dudes, like, just, like, shoving cows onto, like, shipping containers. And he's like, yeah, Japan's like, who would have guessed this? It's like, oh, you mean all that money you poured into restricting a market and not allowing access to it created an economic incentive for people to either fake the beef, fake the sales of the beef, or just steal your cows? Like, you've had to have seen this coming. Like, that's your fault.
Well, we're getting, I think, towards the end of our time here, but do we have any questions that were sent in to us from the last episode we did?
I actually got one question that I'm going to try to not, if I, like, have it up on. I actually got it, like, that didn't load up. There's a is my phone? Like, there we go. Yeah. It's a fairly long question. I'm going to try and anonymize it.
Oh,
but
God.
I think this would be very good for you guys. It's actually kind of a cool question.
Okay.
So I had actually talked to this gentleman on the phone when he called me. So I kind of want to flip this over to you. I'm going to make this very broad. So, Rick, I'm not sure if you know this, but Quincy recently sold the first blockchain bond in U.S. history.
Really?
Yeah. So I get a lot of people asking me about opinions in, like, crypto, which is something I'm not super fan of in terms of its use in public finance. I think it's a tool that traders should have access to. I just don't think, like, a treasury should be holding cash in, like, Ripple.
No.
There's an argument to be made there, but I'm obviously, as somebody who was involved in that, and it was our city that did it, I'm somebody who people will reach out to thinking that I'm going to be like, yes, Doge, only Doge. So I should want to, and they're very surprised when I send back, you know, 30-page responses of me ranting about this. So, but getting a pro. So, do you think there's a place in trading for the use of stable coins as the base mark, abandoning the US dollar and just having some, I don't want to say imaginary, because I don't want to disrespect the argument. I'm just looking for a better word. Like, let's say it doesn't exist yet, but there's some stable coin that is just like always worth the same amount. And that is what would be how you trade stocks and options.
Against that? Like, you'd have to trade everything relative to that?
Correct.
What's the benefit?
Yeah, I mean, that's my argument.
Okay. Like, is it theoretically possible? I mean, you're just swapping out the dollar for
another thing. Let's go back. When was a lot of the pegs of currencies in general broken? They were back when George Soros broke the Bank of England, right? A lot of those things, it was first the gold standard that was removed, and then we started to segue into this stuff. So what would legitimately be, and we went, so I say this, and obviously people can kind of correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of the gold standards and pegs got abandoned due to technological advances and increased appetite for consumption. And this is just an opinion. That's not verified or anything like that.
Dude, that's a pretty solid opinion.
but that's really what it is, right? So we broke all those pegs because we wanted to be able to consume more. And we can now. But the byproducts are that balancing act of inflation, like you said, that inflation is a product, is a function of consumption, but it also is a function of currency and the amount of currency supply. But I would have to say I don't know what the benefit would be. My statement would be that if we were already dealing with something like that, with that free floating currency and not pegged to anything, I can't see what the benefit of a stable coin would be if it's not for anonymity, which it's not really. I mean, there's actually, I think it's the opposite.
It's such a good point, Rick. Oh my word, dude, that was a fire point on the, I will say one thing on the point about like, monetary base being a function of inflation. I don't disagree with that. I'm just saying it's monetary base and money velocity that I think.
Yes, correct.
Or a combination of it. That's really what it is, isn't it? If we really break this down, it's not an economic argument. People just think they're like hiding their money.
Yeah.
Yep. Which is why I don't like it for public finance. It's so funny because this gentleman, I don't want to reveal too much, but he's a wicked smart dude. Like, I just want to be clear. Like, that's brilliant. I mean,
I'm curious to hear what his argument is. Like, what are the benefits he sees for that? If he wants to respond to us.
It's probably to get the government's hands off of the money and have it being regulated by the open market system is what I'm thinking.
But the government likes to sanction people and it's hard to do that when you don't have control of the money.
That's correct. And that's why that won't ever happen, is because there's going to be too much government intervention that's going to have to happen. Yeah. And why is that? Because what was crypto originally used for? Money laundering and buying drugs. I mean, that's Silk Road, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And that wasn't its intention. It's actually supposed to be decentralized. And that's the thing. It got abused immediately because it was almost too good to be true. So
it's also was new and no regulations. I
mean, yep. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And they still don't even know who created it. Like, they just released another documentary on HBO about who is Satoshi Nakamura.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's not something that they still don't know. And it's like, they honestly think it's this guy. I can't remember what the guy's name is.
He's come out and said it's not him, but that's just what Satoshi would say.
Exactly. And that's kind of my whole point. Like, unless, because I'm trying to give the gentleman the benefit of the doubt, it would be for anonymity or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, Rick, I think right on a lot of stuff you said. Like, I want to word this so I don't sound like I'm being pretentious. I think a lot of its application, when people want to use it, is that they view it as a fundamentally good investment, which is not the point of liquidity.
Yep.
The point of liquidity is to reduce risk to the lowest possible point, in that if your reserves being held, liquid or not, the goal is for the highest rate of return. There are better strategies than just holding money in a blockchain-based currency. So it seems to, the desire seems to exist in a market that if you look for risk-adjusted return, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Have you guys ever seen like one of those charts of like points of optimization and that'll be like a point below it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yep.
I feel like there's better strategies, but I think it's kind of shiny. That's what I was trying not to be pretentious about. I think it's interesting if people are like, oh.
I think people are sleeping a lot on the blockchain portion of it. People get excited about the crypto and the volatility and the opportunities that provides. But really, the thing that everyone should be excited about is blockchain. And the things that can unlock.
That's exactly, yeah, I agree with that. Because it doesn't make a lot of sense, because in the grand scheme of things, you're going to be moving that currency and trying to go back to a peg. And the peg is now finite supply, not value to gold. So that's not what we are about. You will never get, especially when we talked about the Americans and consumption and how we're drastically over everybody else, that will not happen. No. Well, why will it not happen? Because, like, let's be honest, there are certain things that I'm able to afford to do as a trader and even trade in the free market and be able to participate because of that never-ending fuel or that never-ending thirst for consumption.
Yeah.
And that's still our job to figure out how to balance inflation at that same rate. But that's why it's just, like I said, it's hard for me to understand the concept of what it would be no matter what. Right now, I think that the use case and what people have been using a lot of crypto for is speculation. And that's kind of it.
That's not necessarily true. I mean, people who are in some of these countries that are experiencing, like Ukraine, like being able to move money, people in countries with the hyperinflation being able to move their assets into something that's not getting hammered by, 70, 80% inflation year over year.
See, and that makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And that's, like we talked about some of the other countries where, wait, how much does Venezuela have on its balance sheet?
I mean, dude, right?
I mean, it makes sense, especially if it gives us the ability. So there's another use case. Gives us the ability to move our money into something that is not tarnished by a government that's corrupt, which that could be the best use case, the most useful use case, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, and to jump off Rick's point, I think when you're talking U.S. to U.S., yeah, you can talk, it's a speculatory point. Kyle, on your point, yeah, absolutely. Like, if you look at look at the world, I mean, 28% of, I think it's still 20, about 28% of India is fully banked. Yeah, Ripple's a good tool there. Mm-hmm. The blockchain, I'm a huge fan of blockchain, obviously. But you look at Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, one of the fastest growing populations in the world, most of their transactions are actually done on cell phone networks, and we all know how horribly unsecure SMS is, right?
Yeah.
So adding a currency that in itself is virtually incorruptible, and you mix in unstable economies, yeah, it's a great tool. My point on the use of it as a point of stability was my retort was, what is it pegged against?
Yes, that was my,
the dollar.
Yes. So
you are holding money in something that can be, fluctuate up and down, or I can have my money sitting in a money market account at 4.5%. Yeah, that's in that money.
But in his case, he was trying to replace the dollar. So then the stablecoin would become the dollar in his scenario.
Yeah. And not this gentleman, but other people. Oh, you met some of the guys at Blockchain Week, Kyle.
Yeah.
They would say that to me and then keep using the term dollar. And I'm like, you're not allowed to use the word dollar after the sentence and replace the dollar, or your argument falls apart. And they're like, they'll just like stare at me as if I'm devoted. I founded four companies and I have 8 LLCs where I'm the CEO of all of them. And this is what I'm like, okay, thank you. I'm going to politely walk over here.
But that's exactly right. It's meant to actually replace it. And yeah. That's why when and I mean, this is going to be a complete tangent, but that's why when everybody's like, wait a minute, but the BRIC system is going to ruin.
Oh,
it's like,
yes,
okay, yeah, it's like, okay,
it.
You let me know you. When that's going to happen. You'll let me know when that's going to happen. But remember it, they like, really, if you think about it, everything is transacted in U.S. dollars. There's no way that a BRIC system is going to ruin a U.S. dollar. Like, there's all major currency pairs are transacted in U.S. dollars. So,
oh, Rick, you're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong.
What's
you're
that?
You're supposed to promote BRICS if you want to get them really fired up.
Oh yeah, no, I just think it's. I mean, I was dropped on my head as a kid a couple of times, but not one too many times to believe in a BRIC system.
I mean, one of my hardest moments of my life being an economist was at last year's Economic Outlook, and I did a slide on U.S. trade use of dollars, and I made a fake chart, and it showed like the yuan, renminbi, what the hell they call it. Competing against the U.S. dollar, and I was like, "Oh, look how close they are!" And I was like, "No, this is a reality, and it's a U.S. dollar." It's like, I mean, the renminbi's like not even 1.5%, and I just went on. I had to be so careful. I felt so. I'm surprised they invited me back because of like I had to contain myself a lot because I was just like, I cannot think of a worse organization than BRICS. It is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. Let's take a bunch of countries that hate each other and have ongoing border disputes. And let's combine a currency.
Yeah.
I started describing as OPEC Part Two. Let's see if a bunch of countries that historically hate each other can be unified by their hatred for the United States. And yep. It doesn't work. It just
no,
doesn't work. Because you know what all the rich oligarchs and autocrats in those organizations love? Greenbacks, man.
Yeah. India loves America, man.
Dude, they do. Yeah. I've had many good Indian friends.
Me too.
Yeah.
There's no way. Yeah. That's never going to be a thing because the funny thing is that remember it was last year that everybody kept talking about the BRICS system and replacing the US dollar on Twitter. And all of a sudden I remember on our trusty Fred app, you could go on there and see that year over year, US dollars were transacted more. And it was increasing. And I was just like, okay, so there goes that BRIC system.
Oh, Rick, you want to get more wild? This is one of the graphs I showed. I said, here's US dollars. I then showed the graph for currencies that are US pegged. And it's like, you guys know this, but trade, just for the listeners, trade's not 100%. It's 200% is how they do those markets. So like 86% of the markets are direct US exchange dollars. And then I think globally that number is much, much higher. I think you get to like the 120s, 130s. But if you include pegged to US dollars, it's like, oh, of that 200%, it's like 175% for US to US pegged dollars. And then that difference is like countries that the US has like military alliance, like mutual defense alliances with. It's like there's like 2%. It's like the renminbi. And like, it's like, oh, all these, because like, here's the thing. If you can get sanctioned by OFAC, if you can be sanctioned by OFAC, you've abandoned the US dollar already, so you're not in the market getting traded. And if you're not sanctioned by OFAC, you're going to use US dollars. So it's like, those are your two options. And the US Treasury decides both these things. Real quick, getting back to the Egypt thing, the reason I was picking Egypt and Ethiopia is Ethiopia's filling up the Grand Renaissance Dam, and they're just like damming up the Nile. And like Egypt has like a wicked bad water crisis.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I heard
not
about
saying
it.
Water. I'm not saying water wars, but I am saying water wars.
All right. Any other thoughts you guys want to leave us on before I read this outro script here?
No, I'm good. I'm happy I ended on dams instead of me having a mental breakdown about bricks again. Positive for my life.
All right. I think that's going to do it for this episode. As always, thank you to everyone for sticking around to the end. Those of you who made it past our... where did we go off topic again?
Right away.
Around Ethiopia. Yeah, right away.
Before that. Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of all over there. If you made it to the end of this, thank you. A special thank you to Eric Mason for neglecting his civic duties to come wrinkle our smooth brains tonight. Check out theinformaleconomist.com if you want to see more of Eric's work. And if you have any questions about what was covered today, email or DM them to us. Be sure to answer them next time Eric returns. Be back soon with another exciting episode, hopefully more successful than China's stimulus plans.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. If you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. Choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
But until then, like, share, subscribe, all the things, and have a great day. This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only, does not constitute financial or investment advice, and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions. The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations.
Produced by China Shop Productions.